Good evening, and welcome to the 2012 Augsburger Lecture Series. The Augsburger Lectureship on Evangelism and Mission is awarded to distinguished scholars or practitioners to address pertinent topics in the areas of Christian evangelism and mission. I see Myron just came in, so I want to make sure that I publicly thank Myron and Esther Augsburger for their foresight and generosity in founding this lecture series back in 1984. Myron, as many of you know, is president emeritus of EMU and served as president from 1965 to 1980. And his wife, Esther, is an artist who created this work and various other works that you'll see around campus. We're glad to have Myron with us this evening. This year's Augsburger lecturers are Alan and Eleanor Kreider. Each of them are both scholars and practitioners whose years of study and service around the world have given them insight into some of the most important contemporary questions about how the church should engage the world. After receiving his bachelor's degree from Goshen College, Alan pursued further study at Princeton University, Heidelberg University, and received his PhD at Harvard in 1971. Eleanor also graduated from Goshen College, and we won't hold that against them. She received her master's in music at the University of Michigan and pursued further study in Christian liturgy at Notre Dame and at King's College of the University of London. Each of them have authored or edited numerous books and articles. Alan's scholarly writing has focused primarily on the origin of Christendom in the West, while Eleanor has published widely on Christian liturgy and worship. In 2005, she co-edited Take Our Moments and Our Days, an Anabaptist prayer book. Together, Alan and Eleanor have written books on what it means to be a peace church, and their most recent co-authored book, published just last year, is Worship and Mission After Christendom. The Kreiders spent 26 years as scholar practitioners in England, where they directed the London Mennonite Center and also held faculty positions at Oxford University. Alan directed Oxford's Center for the Study of Christianity and Culture, and Eleanor was a lecturer in liturgy and worship. They've experienced a Christendom culture in Europe and actually had front row seats in observing its decline there over the past several decades. This experience has provided the framework for their thought about worship and mission. They've seen the relevance of Anabaptist theology and practice for a post-Christendom culture. Alan and Eleanor are the co-founders of the Anabaptist Network in England and had much to do with the increasing interest in Anabaptism among British Christians. They believe worship and mission are central concerns of the Christian faith and hold a passion for integrating the two, and we're going to hear more about that tonight. Peace, reconciliation, and the early church are interests that have undergirded their work, both in England and now in the U.S., where they have served on the faculty of Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminaries and as roving mission educators for the Mennonite Church. So please join me in welcoming Alan and Eleanor Kreider as the 2012 Augsburger Lecturers.
Thank you for having us. We're very happy to be here. We came here by train from Elkhart, and while Alan was sleeping, I was looking out the window, and at one place I saw mining going on. There were people obviously thinking there was some treasure underground. And that's sort of what we're going to be working with tonight, the idea of mining.
Beneath the surface, there are treasures that have been buried that await our excavation. Unexpected things that can come and be resources to us today.
So we're going to be talking about mining the early church for mission. Mining the early church.
And we sense that the Christians of the early centuries, they don't have authority in our lives, they aren't scripture, the New Testament is that. But these early Christians speak to us especially in this time when Christianity is facing problems that it's not totally clear how it's going to cope with.
But people sense that mining the past, especially the early church, can point the way forward.
Now, it's not surprising that this has especially been characteristic of the Roman Catholics. The Catholics call this mining of the past ressourcement, the self-renewal of a people from the original sources of its own life.
Renewal from the sources. From about 1950 onwards, this mining of the past has had a really profound effect on Roman Catholic life.
Ressourcement was one of the major streams that flowed through Vatican II, and then through the Council, ressourcement helped to shape Catholic liturgy, theology, and religious communities.
But especially the scholars and thinkers were drawing on writers of the early church.
A Catholic theologian, Henri de Lubac, said, "Each time the Catholic renewal has flourished, it's flourished under the sign of the fathers."
The sign of the fathers. That's how the Catholics talk about ressourcement.
But you know, in the 21st century, it's not only Catholics who are practicing that, because evangelicals are also rushing to mine the past. We're seeing a new flurry of ressourcement, with evangelicals taking the lead.
This movement owes a lot to Robert Weber, whose mission was to enable evangelicals to mine the early church so that congregations can live what he called the ancient future life now, drawing on the past and then energizing the new.
And you know, there's just tremendous energy in this. There's a kind of evangelical gold rush to mine the early church.
A flood of books and articles. And there was a very interesting and important conference held at Wheaton College called the Wheaton Theology Conference in 2007.
Now, why was this conference important? Of course, it was in Wheaton, which is evangelical, either Harvard or Mecca, depending whom you're talking to. It was well attended. There was excitement, a sense of expectancy, and buzz. And evangelical leaders were there, as well as keen, enthusiastic young evangelical Christians.
And there's a whole spectrum of people in attendance, Calvinists and Methodists, Anglicans and Anabaptists, new monastics and ancient future liturgists, all kinds of people.
And many of the conference papers have appeared in this InterVarsity Press book called Ancient Faith for the Church's Future.
We both were privileged to attend this conference, and Alan actually gave a lecture at the conference, and we found it very encouraging.
In fact, we find evangelical ressourcement, evangelical mining, encouraging in general. We saw evangelicals mining treasures in the Christian past in a way that appeared to us to be new for many evangelicals, and that seemed to be opening them to ways in which God can speak freely to our situation today, and we were full of gratitude.
But it struck us, the mining of the past, this ressourcement that both Catholics and evangelicals have done, poses new questions.
One question is, if you're mining the early church, what is the early church? In the introduction to the volume of Wheaton Essays, the editor says, "We believe that Christianity cannot meet the challenges of modernity and postmodernity without returning to the tradition of the early church."
The tradition of the early church. Now, what does that mean?
Well, some contributors to the volume assume that there is an early church whose tradition extended across the first 5 centuries of the church's history.
Well, that sounds neat, 5 centuries.
And continuities? Of course there are continuities through those first 5 centuries. But there are huge changes as well. If you think of a representative document of the late first century, the Didache, and a representative document of the early 5th century, Augustine's De Doctrina Christiana. They're written in different worlds, and they say things that are very, very different. And it doesn't seem to us to be helpful to speak about the early church as if there were one tradition.
Why doesn't that work? It's because it doesn't take into account the enormous changes that were taking place during those 5 centuries. And so we've come to talk about these changes, to describe them in terms of 2 gestalts, 2 models, 2 configurations.
Gestalt 1, earlier Christianity, the Christianity of the first 3 centuries, which we call the gestalt of the house, of the domestic dwelling, This was a gestalt in which Christians were powerless, marginal, scorned, at times persecuted.
But still, they were growing rapidly. They met in domestic settings, and they repudiated violence and coercion.
And their approach to life issues such as birth, burial, the plague, killing, war, was distinctive. They didn't grow because they had the power of wealth.
They grew because they were attractive Christians. That's Gestalt 1, the Gestalt of the house.
Gestalt 2, the later early church. In the course of the 4th century, the Emperor Constantine adhered to the church, and things began to change. Not instantly, but pretty rapidly. And by the 5th century, a second Gestalt had come into being, whose facets were configured differently.
And so we call this the Gestalt of the Basilica, the large public building in which Christians worshipped. The Christian church had continued to grow.
But now it grew for new reasons. The emperors identified themselves with the church. They showered the church with privileges and endowments.
And upper-class men, the aristocrats, began to come into the church, and they emerged as the leaders of the church.
And so now, in Gestalt 2, being a Christian was not a way to get persecuted. It was a way to get ahead and to rule.
And so this is what we call Gestalt 2, the church of early Christendom, the later early church.
Now, all of this happening within 5 years, the first okay, 5 years,
centuries.
5 centuries, the tradition of the early church. And the changes are perhaps most striking of all in the area of mission.
In Gestalt 1, the early years, the church grew by attraction.
But in the 4th century, the church began to grow by advantage, and in the 5th century, it grew by compulsion.
So from attraction to advantage to compulsion.
And we ask, in terms of mission, is it illuminating to deal with these 5 centuries as though they represented one tradition, consecutive, univocal?
At least in the area of mission, we're proposing that it is not helpful, but we do need to notice this gestalt shift. We cannot base our life today, our ressourcement, on both of them at the same time. We need to discriminate, to discern between them.
And so this leads us to a second question. What are we going to do with what we find as we mine? What we unearth. A lot of people involved in mining are prospecting for things that confirm their beliefs and justify their prejudices about how we Christians today should live.
So, ressourcement is all too often an exercise in self-justification. When perhaps we are feeling insecure, or we're involved in debate.
Or are hunting for evidence. For example, I engaged in debates about the early church because I was eager to prove that the Christian church originally was pacifist. I was hunting for justification. I dug, I mined, and guess what I found? And I think I was right. Anyway.
But working together on this, mining together, we have found things about both worship and mission that have really transformed our lives, our thinking, our ministries, and our understandings of the faith.
We've now been talking about the early Christians for over 30 years, and it's out of these conversations that we bring to you our lecture tonight. We've been especially interested in the way the early Christians worshiped and in the way they approached mission.
Especially in Gestalt 1, that early, earlier, early church.
And we find ourselves learning from the Christian's thought and behavior.
This was before Christendom.
Before Constantine 1.
Before the Christian alignment with the empire.
Our study of these earlier Christians leads us to 4 observations, each of which we think brings illumination into mission, and each of which we then are going to try to show has implications for us today. And we would now like to show you just a few pictures that will give you a bit of a flavor of what we're going to be doing. That is an apartment building in ancient Rome. It is multi-story in height, and what we're going to show you now is a plan for what that would have been like on ground level. Next. Oops, before that. This is what it would have looked like from the vantage point of somebody walking along the street. Whoops.
There we go. Noise?
Tumult.
Stench? Danger? People throwing things out of windows? And then on the first level, see that little group meeting in there? Very probably a Christian group meeting in an apartment building. Next. Now this is something that shows you what that might have looked like. And scholars are just working on this now. This is brand new.
This is a ground plan of that first picture that we showed you.
Yeah, you can see up there on the top, number 6, a tiny little apartment. Next to it is 7, which extends way down there. And it is proposed that number 7 is the kind of building, the kind of part of that big building that the early Christian congregations might well have met in. But there are much larger units here. Look at number 4. See the door at the top?
So what we're seeing here is a ground plan of a very large building that has many small segments in it. And scholars are telling us that Christian groups might have worshipped in small units or in larger units. Sometimes they could expand, open walls, or move to the neighbors. But just think about how close they would have been if a Christian church was meeting in any one of those segments, very near their neighbors. The neighbors would know, they would hear, they would see them as they came and went. So this gives you a sense of a large building with lots of little, like a little comb, honeycomb.
Now, this is a larger structure. This is a well-known early Christian survival on the border of Iraq and Syria, in Dura Europas. And this is a house of the church. It's an entire domestic dwelling, which obviously belonged to a family of some means. There's a door down there, an atrium in the middle, and then off it, there is a meeting room on the left, and a baptistry on the right, and then there are various storage rooms as well. So this has for a long time been given as a model for normal Christian buildings. And what scholars are saying today is that this kind of thing was rare. Far more common was for Christians to live in a warren of urban flats. Big buildings carved up into small buildings, but which were flexible because you could knock down walls, you could add property to property, and it was possible to be a domestic structure and really be quite large numerically. Next. Just to remind us, this is one of the most typical ways the early Christians depicted themselves.
This is a painting from one of the walls of a catacomb, a picture of Christians at table together.
Next. Another one, the Christians depicted at table, possibly a Eucharistic table.
What's the word up there on the right? A-G-A-P-E, agape.
Agape, Yes. Agape could well have been a servant who would be called to help serve the group. Next. Here they are exchanging the kiss of peace.
This is a painting that's made of what worship might have been like. But exchanging the peace was very important in early Christians' worship.
Because they always did this before the Eucharist. They had to make peace before they went to the table, and they went to the table every week. Next.
Who's that? Constantine the First. This is the head of a statue. It's all that's left of the statue. The head itself is what?
9 feet tall.
9 feet tall. You can imagine how big the statue was. So this was a gift to the people of Rome. But here is Constantine.
And this is the kind of church that started being building. This is the east end of a church in what is now Jordan. And you will note that the bishop's chair is up at the highest spot in there, that there is a fence surrounding the entire area where clergy would be.
So this is now a basilica. When we talk about the gestalt of the basilica, this is what the front end of a basilica looked like.
Here is another one, Santa Maria in Cosmedine in Rome. Again, notice the fence that separates the clergy from the laity.
Next. And yet another church of the same type, a basilica with the fence for the clergy in the front. The altar is fenced in. People would stand to worship.
Magnificence. Beauty of mosaic, beauty of execution in general, gold everywhere. And here is a Eucharistic picture dating from
the 6th century in Syria. And here is Jesus serving his disciples at what would have been the Last Supper, except now it's become a solemn Eucharist. So you notice the serving of bread on the right.
So you have the Lord doing both, serving the bread, and the Lord also serving the cup.
Yeah. The nature of the meal has changed.
Next.
And it has moved toward the Mass of the Middle Ages, in which people don't take part but look on. Next. Oh my, we have just entered our own period. You will note why later, but here is, do you know who?
This is a cartoon. This is St. Peter at the gate.
And he is trying to check on his iPad to see whether Steve Jobs should be admitted to heaven. Next. And here's a bus that has been traveling around London.
Well, oh. Maybe we should say what was on that.
Well, there's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life.
Mm-hmm. So this was an advertisement in London on a public bus.
Next.
This is now a picture of a Mennonite congregation. I think that's Blooming Glen.
I think so.
Blooming Glen.
Yeah.
A big Mennonite congregation.
In post-Christendom, some churches are going to be large. And some are going to be meeting, like this house church in England, in somebody's
kitchen.
Sort
big,
of,
big
yeah,
kitchen, yeah,
a rather largish kitchen for England.
Right, next.
And here is a house church meeting in East London. This was done by Andrea Craybill.
It's an etching that she made on the basis of a photograph that was taken at a farewell communion meal with her when she left London.
So, well, these are pictures. Thank you, Joanne. And we will return to our lecture text. Now, we're going to give four observations, which we are going to explain, and then we're going to apply them. The first observation, and that is that in pre-Christendom, that is, in the years of the first three centuries, the church's witness didn't depend upon its worship being attractive to outsiders.
Now, we noticed this morning that in the time of Paul, in that Corinthian church, that outsiders were present. But something happened. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, the severe persecution that began in Rome under Nero and then spread in coming years. Persecution began so that Christians closed the door to the houses in which they were worshiping. And they refused to open the doors to anybody who had not been baptized, that is, the doors to the Eucharist. And they refused to open the doors to even the service of the word, the prayers and the reading of scripture and the preaching for people who had not begun the catechumenate. And so, shutting the doors to the outsiders, why did the Christians do this?
Well, surely the matter of security must have been very important. As Origen put it in the 240s, Christians perform their rites and teach their doctrines in secret. They do this with good reason, to escape the penalty that hangs over them.
So the Christians closed their doors, even though this led to widespread gossip. People are naturally interested in things they can't get in to see. According to a 3rd century apologist, their form of feasting is notorious. It is in everyone's mouth.
And this reflects the tendency of Christians' critics to project their lurid imaginations onto the private behavior of the Christians. But it also showed that the Christians were interesting enough to gossip about them.
And so the churches posted deacons at their doorways to debar the outsiders from coming into their meetings. Imagine! The deacons were bouncers.
And yet, at the same time, the number of outsiders who wanted to get into the church, who wanted to come in and become Christians, that number grew steadily.
According to Rodney Stark, the growth was about 40% per decade. Now, why the growth?
It could not have been because the worship was attractive, because we know the people could not be there. Unbelievers were not allowed.
But the Christian communities were growing, and they persisted in weekly, at times daily, meetings for worship.
So imagine them now worshiping in those spaces that we saw pictures of. They were near to their neighbors. They were observable.
But noticeable. The neighbors couldn't get in there to see. What do they do? You can imagine the gossiping that went on. And one wonders to what extent the neighbors would have said, they may be interesting, because of the worship that they are doing.
What they're doing behind those doors.
Yeah.
So that brings us to observation two. In this early church worship, Christians glorified God, and God then changed them into attractive Christians.
According to the patristic scholar Everett Ferguson, the worship of the early Christians was especially characterized by praise.
He has retorted and told us that their sermons imparted the teachings and the story of Jesus and made them practical to their life.
They prayed, wrestling with God.
Their readings at times included letters from other churches in other parts of the world.
And their worship every Sunday contained the Eucharist, in which the believers thankfully feasted on God.
And so Ferguson tells us, in their worship, they delighted in God. They praised God. They glorified God.
Their worship was God-centered. But their worship had a peculiar byproduct, which was formation.
As the worshipers were worshiping God, God was active. God was there, forming them individually and as a community to be attractive, question-posing Christians.
Second century author Athenagoras wrote, "With us, you will find unlettered people, tradesmen, and old women. They aren't able to express in words the advantages of our teaching, but they demonstrate by acts the values of their principles. For they don't rehearse speeches, but they evidence good deeds.
When struck, they do not strike back. When robbed, they do not sue. To those who ask, they give, and they love their neighbors as themselves."
Now, this and other texts indicate that the Christians lived in a distinctive way, and people who watched them wondered, why do they live like this?
What was it that shaped these Christians to be distinctive people? Now, the ordinary believers may not have realized that it was their worship.
But there's evidence that the early Christian leaders knew that the worship had formative power. Take, for example, a third century document, the Dita Scalia Apostolorum.
Each Sunday, after the prayers, but before the Eucharist, the deacon would stand up and say, "Is there someone here that holds a grudge against his brother?"
At this point, when the community gathered for worship exchanged the kiss of peace, members who during the week had offended each other asked forgiveness.
They made peace, and they exchanged the greeting of peace before participating in the Eucharist.
In fact, they couldn't take part in the Eucharist if they had not been reconciled.
The author of this document saw this practice not just as a part of the church's pastoral life,
but he saw it as a part of their missional outreach.
He knew that this community of the Didaskalia was not homogeneous.
He said, "We, by the power of the Lord God, have gathered people from all peoples and from all towns. So the reconciling and kissing that took place when the community met bonded together people who in society were not equals, who were not like each other, who weren't of the same class or the same economic level, who weren't of the same ethnicity."
But all of these varied people in the church's family could exchange the kiss of peace. And this was shocking in the culture. In Greek or Roman society, people kissed on the level. They embraced on the level, not from one class to the other.
This, the Christians in the peace greetings established, that when they exchanged the peace greeting, they were establishing that they were all on the level. And this could both shock outsiders and attract them.
Now, it's surprising to us that in the surviving early Christian sermons, the bishops and the presbyters did not urge the believers to be articulate about their faith.
Now, they may not have needed to. The early Christians may have spoken quite naturally about their faith.
But again and again, the bishops and the teachers did urge the believers, live what you have learned in worship. Live what you have learned.
For example, a second century sermon to Clement admonished the Christians as follows. "In worship, you've received a vision of life in Christ who calls us to love our enemies and those who hate you. Now, live what he says." Why?
So the non-believing onlookers may see that our deeds are worthy of the words we utter.
And so the pagans will not have occasion to scoff at the church. Between the death of the Apostle Paul and the accession of the Emperor Constantine, there were countless evangelists, But the early Christian texts don't pay a lot of attention to them and don't eulogize them.
We don't actually know their names, do we?
No. Nor did the texts urge all believers to engage the outsiders evangelistically.
Instead, they called all Christians living in the presence of the outsiders, in the presence of their neighbors, to live their faith.
And there is evidence that the Christian communities behaved in ways that intrigued the outsiders. For example, the Christians provided free burial for all their members.
They rescued exposed infants from the refuse heaps and raised them as their own children.
In time of the plague, they provided nursing care for desperately ill people, both Christian and pagan.
And they manifested a lifestyle of non-retaliatory patience. Through the Christians' worship, God had shaped them into people who behaved distinctively.
Who demonstrated alternative ways of living. And so we find early Christian apologists appealing to the behavior of Christians as evidence of the truth of the Christians' convictions.
As one apologist put it, Minucius Felix put it about the year 200.
We do not preach great things, but we live them.
We do not preach great things, we live them.
Christians emerge from their worship as attractive, question-posing people.
That's our
second observation.
The third observation.
Rigorous preparation for baptism, that is catechesis, was essential.
It formed the apprentice Christians, preparing them for baptism by teaching, by example, and by experience, so that they developed alternative habits and distinctive reflexes.
According to Justin Martyr, in catechesis, Christians learned and were taught by the fair commands of Jesus.
Why did they have to learn that?
Well, for missional reasons, so that others may share with us the good hope. The teaching, why be nonviolent? So that others may share with us the good hope.
The teachings of Jesus were converting both of the catechumens and of pagans. But how did this work? Justin said, we can point to many who have turned from the ways of violence and tyranny, overcome by observing the consistent lives of the believing neighbors.
Or noticing the strange patience of their injured acquaintance, or experiencing the way they did business with them. Now, Bishop Cyprian's catechesis, a century after Justin, was very similar and was directed to shape the catechumens so they lived simply and lived nonviolently.
In the third century, the Apostolic Tradition, another document, a handbook for bishops, made it hard for outsiders to be admitted to the community. For example, it required those who were admitted to baptismal preparation to attend catechetical sessions for up to 3 years.
Can you believe it? It urged the catechists and sponsors to monitor the catechumens' behavior more closely than their belief, at least initially.
And before finally admitting a candidate for the final preparation for baptism, the Apostolic Tradition had them cross-examined, really, about their behavior.
Have the candidates lived good lives while they were catechumens?
Have they honored the widows?
Have they visited the sick?
Have they done every kind of good work?
If they have, let them hear the gospel. Now, why does the Apostolic Tradition emphasize visiting the sick? Scholars debate this, but what came to me recently after hearing a speech by John Bonk was this. What this document is doing here in emphasizing the sick is emphasizing in shorthand fashion what Jesus was talking about in Matthew 25.
You remember? Jesus said, I was sick. Did you visit me? I was hungry. Did you give me food?
I was thirsty, a stranger,
naked, in prison. Did you help me?
And so it's not surprising that the Apostolic Tradition assumes that people can receive the gospel only after they have been formed to respond to Jesus' presence in needy people.
Only after.
Matthew 25, thus a foundational text for Christian formation.
Why was that?
Because Christian leaders knew that apprentice Christians would develop an understanding of the gospel through lived experience.
We live our way into a new way of thinking. We live our way into a new way of thinking.
And this catechetical journey then culminated in the Easter Vigil in a ritually impressive baptism, in the candidate's first communion, and the product of this.
It was Christians whose lives had been shaped, formed by God.
The baptized who have completed rigorous catechesis have become complete Christians and have been fed with the body of Christ.
They will strive in wisdom so that their life may shine with Christ.
Not before each other only, but also before the Gentiles, so that they may imitate them and become Christians and see that the progress of those who have been illuminated is high and better than the common behavior of people. Rigorous baptismal preparation led to lives that embodied Jesus' teaching and challenged people to become believers.
That's our observation three. Now, the fourth observation is taking note of the domestic setting. The worship of the pre-Christendom churches took place in homes, in domestic settings.
Now, we've seen already a wide variety of domestic
settings. Some of them were meeting in big tenement buildings, as we saw.
Mm-hmm. Less common were the comfortable houses, such as the one that we saw. And the most typical form that we've been looking at recently are these insulae, these urban blocks. They are fascinating because they show that Christians lived in a variety of settings. Some of these, they were able to knock down walls, increase size, and all the while remain domestic in ethos.
In close proximity to each other and to neighbors as well. So Christian groups of 30 to 40 could meet in a domestic unit that maybe began as a stonemason's workshop or on a ground floor.
And a Christian group, as it grew in size, could divide, enlarge, knock down walls, move to a larger unit. You get a sense of dynamism within a restrictive architectural framework.
This is particularly the work of Peter Oakes, who has worked on this particular question. But all the while, we're saying that it maintained this domestic ethos.
And proximity to neighbors. Christians were visible to their neighbors. They were accessible for conversation when the neighbors had questions, when the neighbors were in trouble.
The Christians worshiped where they lived. They lived in the same buildings as where they worshiped, near to their neighbors. So early Christian worship in this Gestalt I took place in domestic settings, in close neighborhoods, in close proximity.
So we've made these four observations. And what are we looking for? What are we finding here? What implications can we draw for mission today?
Well, in the first place, we do not look for a template here. We're not going to find a model that we have to follow or that we could follow. It isn't going to be exactly like what we find in the early period.
And we know that the church as it developed in the early centuries wasn't infallible. The tradition could bend in wrong directions as well as in helpful ones. Some of these directions were not very helpful. One Jesuit liturgical scholar has talked about the developments that took place in the fourth century as the survival of the fittest, not necessarily of the best. But these post-Constantinian developments are a part of our story, and for good or for ill, they have shaped our life as well.
Now, some of these changes in this later part of this period might still be fitting in our own mission today. For example, in the fourth and fifth centuries, Christian churches began to construct those huge buildings, and worship became large scale. Liturgies became glorious with long sermons and rhetorically beautiful, spellbinding sermons.
Now, is this relevant today? Well, maybe in the United States, some megachurches are very successful. In England, some Anglican cathedrals have growing, lively congregations.
Now, of course, size is not always a sign of faithfulness and mission, but well-attended services in cathedrals or in megachurches may very well indicate that large-scale rites of Christian worship that originated in the fourth century contribute to mission today as well.
But other fourth century changes were not so helpful. Christians should not do what the believers were doing in the 420s.
We should not twist arms.
We should not compel Christian behavior.
We should not force people to go to church.
One document in 420 reports that Christians were coming upon Jews and pagans who were living quietly and attempting nothing disorderly.
And laying violent hands upon
them. We shouldn't do that.
One of God's good gifts to us in post-Christendom is that Christians can't do this anymore.
We cannot coerce belief, belonging, or behavior.
Indeed, in our opinion, the missional practices that seemed a good idea to the 4th and 5th century predecessors are often bad ideas for us.
So we think that if we look to the 4th and 5th centuries for insight in the area of mission, we will largely have come to a dead end.
And this is why, for mission, we go back to the earlier period.
To the pre-Christendom early church, to Gestalt I.
And this Gestalt points to relevant clues and offers us gifts.
And so let's look at those four observations that we made and convert them into hypotheses for today. The first observation was, in pre-Christendom, the church's witness didn't depend on its worship being attractive to outsiders.
So the hypothesis that we present now is that today also, in post-Christendom, our church's witness will not depend on our church's worship being attractive to outsiders.
Remember, in the pre-Constantinian church, the church was growing without the presence of the outsiders, and it can be like that for us today.
But let's think what happened in the centuries between Constantine and today.
Between the 4th and the 6th century, Christian worship was gradually opened up to all. First by the widespread practice of making infants catechumens.
And then by making infant baptism compulsory.
And soon the church was the place to which everybody in society had to go.
But in late Christendom,
that is in the 19th and 20th centuries,
church attendance plummeted. And many people still felt guilty about not going to church. Or maybe they were hunting for a church where they could return.
This kind of thing worked for a while.
This is a period we often hear the word revival. The people were called back to something they longed for.
Breathing life into something old and familiar that has gone to sleep or nearly died.
But today, after Christendom, many people have lost connection with the Christian story.
They've got no latent sense of guilt. And if they're searching for spirituality, they don't expect that their longings will be met by going into a church building.
In fact, many people today are even repelled by the thought of entering a church building.
These people find secularist propaganda sensible. They view it as a truism that religions are intrinsically violent. In fact, a lot of people have had bad experiences with Christians that seem to bear out well-attested reports of Christian conflict, manipulation, and abuse.
So it is unlikely that large numbers of outsiders will stream into our worship.
Now, this shouldn't stop Christian worship leaders from being culturally sensitive as they enculturate our worship services.
But mining the early church can help us see that in mission, the attractiveness of Christian worship to outsiders is not the main issue, not the main issue.
Our hypothesis is that our churches can grow even if no outsiders are there.
On Sunday morning.
But how? So our second observation. In pre-Christendom worship, Christians glorified God, and God then formed the Christians into attractive Christians.
Our hypothesis then is that this is still true. In our worship today, we will glorify God, and God will form us into attractive Christians.
As in the early centuries, we Christians need to keep our focus on God, and this focus changes us. We today will praise God for God's attributes and God's actions, which give us a sense that God is alive and real, breaking into human experience.
Our services will have sermons that tell God's story and inspire us to join our lives to the story of the scripture.
Our prayers will still wrestle with God, calling on God to move mountains and to bring faith and justice to our time.
Our communion services will enable us to feast at God's table and to make all of our meals Eucharistic.
Our services will have reports from the front, testimonies of God's actions in our time, as our members engage in contemporary equivalents of the early Christian approaches to burials, babies, the plague, and violence.
This worship will change us. It will form us. It will edify us, build us up individually and as a community, build us up in the body of Christ, bring us to maturity, people who know that we are loved, who are becoming equal, reconciling, forgiving.
And neighbors will notice and ask, what's going on with her? And so we ask, What kind of people do the words and liturgical practices of our congregation shape us to be? Do they form us into attractive, question-posing people whom the neighbors notice with intrigue?
In many post-Christendom societies today, Christians are encountering an articulate, secularist, atheist apologetic. And this is carried not only by philosophic prose,
but also by buses.
Billboards and ads on the sides of buses, as we saw on that bus in London. There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life.
Now, how should Christians respond to this? Well, one way is the answer of apologetics. And this can be very helpful, as is indicated by a recent book by Anglican theologian Alistair McGrath, Why God Won't Go Away.
He offers an argument that we think could have a future if the mining of the sort we are proposing takes hold. The atheist argument is that religion is intrinsically violent, and this is a truism.
But McGrath counters this by pointing to nickel mines.
He tells of the aftermath of the killing in 2006 of Amish schoolgirls in Pennsylvania.
Now remember, the Amish whose neighbor had shot five of their young girls stunned the world by shunning revenge.
Instead, without forethought, they reflexively, immediately offered forgiveness.
Now, McGrath admits that their behavior is a challenge to churches, he puts it, to bring their ethics into line with those of their founder.
But even more, he argues, this counters the new atheist argument that religion is intrinsically violent. Now, this is a wonderful passage in McGrath's work. But we wonder,
what if McGrath had been able to do what the apologists of the early church did?
What if he had been able to draw upon stories of Anglicans as well as of Amish?
Of Pentecostals and Baptists and Catholics to show that God's forgiving in Christ makes Christians into forgiving people.
What if Christians formed by their worship had offered McGrath not three paragraphs of embodied argument about the Amish,
but 33 paragraphs or 33 pages
of embodied argument drawn from all Christian traditions?
What if the churches were communities that collect and celebrate the stories of life-giving, Jesus-like, countercultural behavior?
When communities live this kind of life,
and we could cite a bunch of Mennonite examples, which we often give in places other than this,
then God's mission goes forward, and neighbors recognize that they may or may not agree with the story. They may or they may not want to take part.
But there is something here that they've got to take seriously, and some neighbors will wonder, what kinds of beliefs form the Christians to be the kind of people who behave like that?
They might wonder, what kind of worship shapes Christians to be question-posing like that? Forgiving people?
And they will want to come and talk. And by God's grace, they will become friends, and in due course, they will want to enter the church's door.
They may. When we keep the focus on God, the God of Jesus Christ, God changes us into attractive, Christ-like, countercultural Christians in Christian communities who embody the good news.
And so our third observation. We talked about the importance of rigorous preparation for baptism by teaching example and experience.
And the same is true today. So our third hypothesis here is that rigorous baptismal preparation remains essential. It forms apprentice Christians, preparing them for baptism by teaching example and experience so that they develop habits and distinctive reflexes.
In Christianity's early years, the believers weren't only shaped by worship before they experienced the Eucharist. Before they experienced Eucharistic worship, they had been prepared by up to 3 years of preparation.
3 years.
3 years of pre-baptismal.
So what happened to those 3 years of baptismal preparation?
Well, in the centuries after Constantine, the church's baptismal preparations became shorter and their focus changed. Changed from transformed behavior into correct belief.
So in Gestalt 1, the emphasis was on Christians living in a distinctive way. In Gestalt 2, the later early church,
the focus came to be solely, I mean, the earlier period trained people in correct belief too. Yeah. After they had learned,
Behavior came first.
That's right. But before baptism came belief. But now the
Behavior disappeared. Belief stayed. And, you know, you find catechists, I've been studying this in the fourth century, who are equipping people to avoid Montanism, but give no help in avoiding militarism. And in the High Middle Ages, when infant baptism was universally practiced, you find catechesis disappearing. Now today, in post-Christendom, we believe that baptismal preparation is more necessary than ever. It's essential in forming apprentice Christians.
Why? Why is this so important?
Well, because never in history have we been surrounded by catechesis that is as all-pervasive and as seductive as what we are facing today.
The church's capacity to form its members is simply overwhelmed by a mix of internet, television, and advertising.
And that's why we offer you a picture of Steve Jobs.
For spiritual and life formation, who can compete with Steve Jobs, with Bill Gates,
with Fox News, with ESPN? These simply swamp the formational capacities of our Sunday services, our youth groups, our pre-baptismal classes.
So what can we offer when our prospective believers are immersed in Twitter, texting, and games, when their parents are working too hard,
distracted, commuting, and when the culture industries are catechizing everyone without ceasing? What can the church offer? Three weeks of catechetical sessions?
5 weeks? Mining the genius of the early Christians and learning from their baptismal practices suggests this.
We need not 5 weeks, but 50 weeks. Or 100 weeks.
Why?
Because the early Christians knew that it took time and group process to reshape the lives and thought of the candidates.
And because they knew that catechesis required hands-on experience. They had to learn by practice, by life experience, how to care for the sick, how to visit the prisoners, how to be nonviolent.
In other words, how to live as Christians. The Christians, we have said, did not think their way into a new life. They lived their way into a new kind of thinking. Now, some traditions today are working on this. The outstanding example of tradition requiring rigorous catechesis is, of course, the Mormons.
They require their late teens to do 2-year mission assignments, and we have seen them, haven't we, around our cities. And this has done much to educate the volunteers into the identity and lifestyle of the Mormon Church.
The Mormons also have seminaries, that is, 4-year programs for youths aged between 14 and 18.
These seminaries meet before school, often as early as 6 a.m.
And they teach, in addition to Christian and Mormon scriptures, they teach how to navigate high school, how to stay good and pure and righteous.
This sounds like the early third century church.
And the Mormon church is growing. Now, the Roman Catholics have also been attempting something similar in their RCIA, the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults.
Now, this has been controversial, but in many dioceses and parishes, it has transformed catechesis and has brought new commitment to the Christian faith and Christian lifestyle.
In other traditions, including some Protestant traditions, there have been institutions of demanding catechetical programs modeled on early Christian catechesis, and these have worked. As a general rule, we say, those groups flourish that make demands on young people, that appeal to their ideals, that engage them in high-threshold activities, and that put them to hands-on work, helping the weak. Matthew 25, visiting the sick, visiting the old, doing something that inconveniences them but enables them to learn how to be servants, physically as opposed to intellectually.
So that's our
third hypothesis. Now our final hypothesis.
The fourth observation had to do with Christian worship taking place in domestic settings, in many settings, very close to their neighbors.
And our fourth hypothesis, and that is the worship of post-Christendom churches takes place in many settings, of which the domestic are increasingly common. Now, we believe that in our time, the church is starting to go home. As we saw, The pre-Christendom churches worshipped in domestic settings. But in the 4th century, in early Christendom, as Gestalt II took place, the church left home.
Its worship moved from houses into public buildings. And we hear Constantine the Great, as we saw his picture there, fulminating against groups that met in private houses.
And bishops joining the emperor in fulminating.
Why?
Because Christianity was becoming a religio, a public faith.
It was to meet in large buildings and often in those great basilicas.
And in these, the worship was glorious. There were huge candles, mosaics, and vestments.
Musicians developed their skills, and the preachers and the liturgists reached unprecedented heights of excellence.
And some people were impressed.
But there were losses. The size of the congregation, the size of the buildings, made face-to-face interaction difficult.
The kiss of peace continued to take place, but there were so many people that it was almost impossible to have this as a time when actual reconciliation took place.
And the exercise of gifts by different members became unwelcome as the services came to be dominated by the clergy.
The task of the deacons in a 4th century Syrian church was to, quote, watch over the people and keep them silent.
So in ironic reversal, in the Christendom centuries, it was the heretics and the pagans who met in private places.
And who feared that the authorities might knock on the door, and the Anabaptists are there in those private spaces. But today, in many countries, including Canada and the United States, Christians are once again worshiping in homes. Of course, many Christians continue to meet in big buildings, where large congregations can participate in services in the classic Christendom traditions.
And positive things are happening here, obviously. But in many places, smaller congregations are struggling to maintain their buildings that now seem to be too large for them.
In post-Christendom, there clearly will be lots of variety. Inherited churches, traditional churches as well as house churches, big churches as well as cell churches, traditional churches as well as table churches. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, wrote recently.
He said, today we have a mixed economy of church life, a mixed economy. There are ways of being church alongside the inherited parochial patterns.
New ways of being church.
A mixed economy.
In post-Christendom, Christians are finding a variety of ways of meeting, and increasingly, these meetings are in homes.
Now,
why?
We just want to look at this. Why is this happening, or what is the what's the rationale?
Well, for economic reasons. Church buildings are very expensive to maintain. Houses are more affordable, and they are dual-purpose places.
Missional reasons. Houses are liminal spaces where people who are allergic to Christendom Christianity, they can come without feeling sick, offended, or threatened.
Pastoral reasons. People who meet in homes discover the joy of face-to-face Christianity, in which relationships are built and the one another life of the New Testament can be realized.
Love one another.
Encourage one another.
Greet one another.
Forgive one another.
And many other one another's.
Liturgical reasons.
The combination of form and freedom once again emerges. The church becomes multi-voiced as the gifts of many participants are used, not only those of the ordained ministers.
And 1 Corinthians 14 comes into its own, and all can take part, the Laos.
And the last reason we list,
but not the least,
is the ministry of gastronomy. People need food, and they love to share food together.
And meals with real food are hospitable. Further, as missional pastors know, meals are often where things happen.
At table, encounters take place. People reveal the secrets of their hearts.
At table, people meet God.
So for economic reasons, missional, pastoral, liturgical, and gastronomical reasons, people are being drawn to worship in the home.
So, as the larger church buildings are joined by a growing number of houses, and as people come to faith in domestic settings, this is not a sign of immaturity. It is rather an opportunity to take seriously parts of the New Testament that throughout the Christendom centuries were ignored. Texts that have to do with multi-voiced worship, with one another church life, and above all, this is a time to participate in God's mission.
Now, to be sure, the mixed economy will be mixed, and many people, possibly most people, will not worship in houses, and house churches will face big questions. For example, how will they catechize the children and the youths who sit at table with them?
How will they maintain their sense of belonging to the larger Christian family, including nearby inherited churches and the global church?
How will they guard their lives against incomplete or destructive theology and accommodation to society?
Will God call forth enough gifted leaders to serve as the pastoral hearth of each house church?
The small churches will face questions.
But you know, in post-Christendom's mixed economy, the churches meeting in large buildings are also going to face questions.
How, in large gatherings, will they give voice to all the members?
How will they give voice to testimony in which worshipers report the inbreaking actions of the missional God?
And how, in our pressured society, how will their worship form a body whose members actually know each other and love each other and share food and goods?
In an uncurious and skeptical world, how will their worship equip Christians to live in a way that embodies alternatives to the dominant values of society?
And how will the large churches accept the fact that there are many people who are offended by church culture?
Who are alienated. People of all ages, people with a lot of Christian experiences who are burned out and have gone out the church's back door.
Or young people who are unattracted by the church's traditions and culture.
These are people that the larger congregations will not reach, and I would be pretty sure that we all know people like these. Now, we anticipate that in the coming decades, the Christians in Canada, Europe, and Australasia will live in societies that are increasingly post-Christendom in character. And we expect that the same will also be true of Christians in the United States, despite the determined efforts of some Americans to build a neo-Christendom.
And as we are preparing to live in the post-Christendom reality, we Christians can find renewal, we're convinced. Find renewal as we mine the early church.
As we engage in ressourcement, to be sure, we will be sustained by rich resources from the later early church, that is, from Gestalt II.
We will draw gratefully on creed and canon and on the theological riches of Basil and Augustine.
In Gestalt II, we may even find some missional insights that are useful. For example, when we hear Augustine speaking of the church as an inn, a hospital, in which we as sinners and sinned against can experience God's healing, we will know that this can be missionally as well as pastorally profound.
But we suspect that in many areas, and especially in mission, we will have learned more from Gestalt I, from the earlier Christian church.
Not because we will agree with everything the early Christians did, and not because we will mimic them on every point.
But because they, living before Christendom, are closer to the New Testament, and thus closer to the original sources of our own life.
And further, because we will find intriguing parallels between their situation pre-Christendom and ours in post-Christendom.
And most of all, we will learn from the Gestalt I Christians because they ask us questions that stir our imagination.
And suggest new possibilities. So, let us mine the early church. As we do so, God will equip us to take part in God's mission with buoyancy
and hope. Buoyancy and hope, we recommend to you.